Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 422, January the 4th, 1980, the first tape of 1980. Happy New Year. It seems kind of strange saying Happy New Year when the world is on the verge of such cataclysmic events. But for some reason or other, which I can't explain, I guess it has to do with basic personality or philosophy of life, I don't feel depressed. I see the news as terrible, and yet I wake up optimistic each day, not in a foolish optimistic way, but not in a sad way, and I don't really know why, because things are pretty tragic out there. Bob Trevor was on KGO last night. He's the most intelligent newscaster in San Francisco on the 24-hour talk show. He was on the early hours of the morning, and I woke up around 4 o'clock. I turned on the radio, and he was talking about cutting his wrists and sitting in a tub of water and literally wanting to die because the calls were so pessimistic for the year ahead, the future year ahead. I don't feel that way. I can't explain it, but I don't. And let's get on to the news of this week. Before I get into a lot of the material that I'm going to be sharing with you, which I think is terribly important, I think it is every week, and some articles are keys to the past and the future, and we have a few of those to share at this time. I do want to give you the address on the printed sheet and tell you, for people listening to the radio programs where this tape is played, that there is a newsletter put out by a gentleman in Florida. It's called the King Alfred Research Project. It's a very unsophisticated form. I mean, it's just copies of very important articles, and it's a good way of getting resource material from somebody who is out there looking for these clues and links to the way we are being manipulated. You can send for this. It's just a small newsletter, and I'll give you the address. It's in care of the King Alfred Research Project in Jacksonville, Florida. The subscription is $3 for 8 to 12 pages, and he prints 300 copies. Capers Thompson is the person doing this, and in this package that comes out, he has some very good articles that I will be referring to from time to time, but it saves that much time on the tape if you can just pick up the whole collection. He also has on the back a resource list, which is important, and he mentions the he has 13 various organizations or persons, such as myself, getting out tapes and newsletters, and most of these are fairly inexpensive, and you can keep up with the committees and write to these people for more information on reopening the Rosenberg case and Alpine Enterprises, the Conspiracy Digest. When you get that newspaper, then you also get sheets of addresses and lists of books that are available, addresses of people doing other work. It turns you on to a whole network of concerned citizens around the world, and particularly in the United States. And I think that's one of the things that helps keep my sanity up during these times when the news is so bad, is that I'm only in contact with people who are concerned, who are thinking about these problems, and I don't spend time trying to proselytize or turn people on to the fact that there are conspiracies and they get rejected and hurt. I simply stay with people who already know something of what is coming down and want to know more, and it's an intellectual and emotional challenge, and it bonds you with a type of person that I call a concerned person, and that makes your life much more rich and less helpless when you're in contact with all these various individuals or pieces of literature coming in and become familiar with them. Several years ago, I had a woman on KLRB, and it was on the tapes that went out, who's an organizer for the demonstrations against the Shah of Iran. And they had a newspaper coming out of Chicago called Resistance, and many listeners started taking that right after I got my subscriptions. The Shah was out, but they're still active in other ways, and it's good to keep in touch with these people and know how other people are feeling before the country changes hands, and to understand some of the violence and torture and exploitation. Sit and talk about those things so you're not so taken back when these cataclysmic events take place. If you don't have the printed sheet that accompanies this particular tape or broadcast, it's King Alfred Research Project, Post Office Box 12305, Jacksonville, Florida, 32209. The Associated Press had a story this week that disease samples are shipped unmarked in commercial airplanes. This came out of Atlanta, Georgia. The dangerous disease samples are transported on passenger airplanes illegally, and that this hazardous material should be refused. They're in unmarked containers. They're shipped to medical centers across the nation from various researchers. And Dr. Johnson of the National Center for Disease Control said that he knows there's never been infection as a result of shipping these viruses, bacteria, disease tissue samples, but there could be. The Center for Disease Control said that there's a slim chance that an isolate could escape and spread disease among cargo passengers, and that we ought to get into it. It's really a dangerous thing, that if it were broken open, something terrible would happen. There are about 300 reports in the last 7 years of transportation personnel who spotted, according to this report, a leaking or broken container with a red warning label with a telephone number to report to the health authorities. The labels are supposed to be crucial, with only trained medical epidemiologists opening disease packages. And they warn the dangers of airplanes going to airports like International, New York, and so forth, because they could ship thousands of diseased-filled containers each day. I just bring that up because it's typical of the insanity of our society that we're shipping these things around the country and endangering the population. I hear about Asian flu or Russian flu or China flu and various predictions of getting flu vaccine, and I just wonder how much disease, knowing the CIA and their way of experimentations, is administered to us and keep the population generally at large and at sick leave and under the weather. Years from now, we'll probably be reading that they deposit disease just as the Americans did, putting smallpox on blankets and then sending the horses with those blankets into the Indian reservations so that thousands of Indians would die from smallpox. This started long before the CIA, but the mentality to allow the CIA to do these things was formed from the habits that preceded it and has never been forbidden, and nobody is punished. Every time we read about CIA experiments and pneumonia and chemical experiments, it's just simply one news event that makes the front page, and I never yet have read a prosecution of the people who are doing it or did it. Only those people, namely the Scientologists and their group For Justice in Government, are the ones that are put in jail for divulging the information. The people who are doing it, nothing happens to them, just the people who tell us that it's happening. Gerald Ford was invited to the White House December 14th, that was about 3 weeks ago, to meet Jimmy Carter on the hostage problem, the Iranian problem, and there was a quotation going back 3 weeks ago, which I hadn't shared with you, because Ford was put in after Richard Nixon was removed by that Scotch tape that we talked about several weeks ago, so that Kissinger, Haig, and Rockefeller would have a firm control over the White House. And with Ford as appointed president, then Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller, became vice president. The sentence that I want to share with you was that Gerald Ford was quoted as saying, from the very beginning, I have said this is probably the most serious international crisis since the end of World War II. It is absolutely essential that we have unity support of the president. The taking of the hostages, allowing the Shah in this country, and then the taking of the hostages is setting the stage to get our troops into the Middle East and surround the Soviet Union and get ready for that World War III that Mr. Brzezinski and Kissinger and their fellow men, if you can call them men, have been cooking up since the end of World War II. Jimmy Carter's rivals are accusing him of using Iran to duck political debates, and as you all know, he refused to debate with the other candidates, Jerry Brown and Ted Kennedy, this week. He has become the wartime president that he is. He has shed the peanut farmer cloak that I have talked about. For those of you that have taken the tapes continuously, there are many new listeners, and as I keep saying, we can't go back all the time. You'll have to just get the other tapes to fill in or pick up from here. But Jimmy Carter was a graduate of Annapolis in the class of 47. He went there with L. Patrick Gray, the acting director of FBI at the time of the Watergate crisis, who was put in there when J. Edgar Hoover was killed. He was an old man, but he was killed so that the Annapolis graduate would be the acting director of the FBI, and, of course, Stansfield Turner, the head of the CIA, the classmate of Jimmy Carter. He has shed his peanut farmer cloak, and he's now gone into the role of the Annapolis Navy intelligence captain of the ship ready for the war, and he's just not about to debate with any of the candidates. When I made these statements several months ago, and I think I've shared this with you before, there were some listeners that thought it would be impossible that Jimmy Carter could use the hostages or prolong this thing for a warfare state. I think many of you are beginning to see now that that's far from impossible. Mr. Waldheim, another German, not Waldheim, it's spelled that way, Waldheim, Kissinger, Brzezinski, the whole team that came over here from Europe are very much in control of our foreign national policy. Mr. Waldheim went to Tehran to meet with the heads of government to discuss the hostage problem. I think when he got there, he realized how much the people in Tehran, all of them, hate the Shah, hate the United States. I think that he was hoping to find some links in the chain that could be broken, some weaknesses, some pleading for us to come over there. And, of course, everybody who goes over there understands that they're interviewed by people who have been tortured by the Savak and mistreated, or members of their family are killed. Mr. Waldheim did not meet a friendly group when he was there, and there was talk of an assassination plot against his life. It reminded me of the trip of Dag Hammarskjöld. I don't know how many of you read any books or articles on the death of Hammarskjöld, September 18, 1961. He went to the Congo and to South Rhodesia to make some form of peace. At the time, he was Secretary General of the United Nations when he was murdered there on a peace mission. In this case, if Waldheim had been murdered, the protection weren't good enough, it would have been another reason to escalate the war, and he could have been sent there to be sacrificed. There were assassination attempts, I understand, on him, and he was protected. He left a cemetery where he was supposed to visit, and of course he can't be in the streets publicly seen. But that could have been another incendiary if Waldheim had been killed. As it is, he is still alive, and so that is one less excuse at the time being to get angry. But Dag Hammarskjöld, on a same type of mission, was murdered in 1961. Jimmy Carter has recalled the ambassador to Moscow. This ambassador, Thomas Watson, is president of IBM, hardly sympathetic to the Soviet Union and been part of that internal business clique that have been anti-Soviet for years. All they'll talk about is the invasion of Afghanistan, but there isn't much that they're going to be able to do about that, short of bringing in troops to supply the rebels. The Soviet Union is afraid of the United States. They're absolutely aware of the war plans for 1985. Mr. Brzezinski has coaxed NATO to put those atomic missiles in seven countries in Western Europe facing the Soviet Union. The New York Times has an analysis this week of why the Soviet Union was forced into Afghanistan, and it's pretty close to my way of thinking. With one error, their article begins by saying that driven by historic near paranoia about the security of its borders, they considered it an unparalleled threat of instability across their southern frontier. Paranoia is a mental disease of fearing an enemy that does not, in fact, exist. Reality is seeing the enemy closing in on you. The Soviet Union is literally isolated because China has become a branch of our Central Intelligence Agency since the death of Mao. All of Western Europe is against the Soviet Union. And if the hostages affair allows us to bring our troops into the Middle East, and with Japan making financial control of South Korea with the death of Parks and maybe combining North and South, the Soviet Union would be totally isolated. So they have to take their strategic moves now, which is not paranoia, it's reality. The Washington Post said the Soviets intend to convert the once autonomous nation into another Mongolia, the total subservient Soviet garrison puppet state that once was set up in 1921 along their Chinese border. The Soviets are considering Afghanistan an integral part of the Soviet military zone and foresee a virtual state of occupation for many years to come. The reasons they give in this Washington Post article, which again I say are similar to mine, is that the SALT Treaty never was going to take place. Our Senate was against it. We have a group of senators that want war, that want a d'entente to be ended. It never really existed except in spelling the word. There's been nothing but a continual confrontation with the Soviet Union. There was a desire to send the Plate Chorus Line over there 2 weeks ago, and the money was pulled back and won't come because the Soviets would send over a group of their artists in exchange. And when they send the ballet, we have coaxed these various people to stay on this side because of the Cold War stature and the prestige of getting them to jump to the American side. The SALT agreements, which the Soviet Union wanted and warned about, were never, ever going to pass the Senate. The rapprochement with China ended in 1976, and although Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon opened up those borders, and it was very prestigious for Richard Nixon's re-election, they sent in Mr. Bush, who was the director of the CIA, and he was the ambassador to China, and now the post-Mao leadership has swung so that China is our 51st state, if it isn't Israel or Puerto Rico or Mexico, and it's not Mexico, although we'd like it to be. China is literally controlled it in exchange for billions of dollars of industry and business and opening up business. We have allowed them to become traditionally anti-Russian, the two giants facing each other anyway, but they're in our camp. So the Soviet Union has broken their rapprochement with China, and they're surrounded, according to the Washington Post, and you can see at the map, if you take a map and follow it this week. They also mentioned the revival of Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan into an Islamic revival, and this would threaten the Soviet Union along that border. And the reasoning or the logic of their moving in, as detailed in the Post, is similar to what I see, that the American position has never been weaker. If we come in with strong weapons and try to get the hostages, they will be killed. If they're killed, we will begin using a bombing of the oil fields and making war over there. And in return, the Muslim countries could pull back our oil and retaliate and cut off the bulk of the oil supplies for the United States. We are economically strangled with the price of gold going so high, jumping very high. The oil, the financial situation has America's back against the wall. It's a hard time to make a war, so this is the strategic moment for the Russians to step in, because they know that the people that run this country hate them, the media is against them, every single thing they do, so they may as well secure their borders while they can. Jack Anderson had a concise article this week called The Shah's System. Many of you don't get the Anderson columns, some of you do, so I just want to mention some that are very important. He tells how the Shah of Iran, of course, was put in by early articles. He tells about the Rockefeller Kissinger CIA connections. Then he tells how Henry Kissinger and the Shah raised our oil prices in the Middle East so drastically, and then how William Rogers, who was Secretary of the State, left the State Department and then became the head of the Pahlavi Institution, the foundation run by the Shah, and his financial investments. In 1973, at the height of the Watergate exposures, William Rogers left the State Department to head the Shah's financial foundations, and the head of our CIA, Richard Helms, who was instrumental in putting the Shah in, then went to Iran in 1973 to 1977, and became the ambassador to Iran, and would tip off people who were anti-Shah in order to keep the Shah's power going. He had a firm called Safir, S-A-F-E-E-R, an Iranian word for ambassador, when he came back, a consulting firm, and his biggest client was the Shah of Iran. And Senator Jacob Jaffetz and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee defended the Shah in Congress for the Senate, and his wife, of course, was a lobbyist, received $67,000 for the Iran Airlines, and that was a cover for pro-Shah lobbying. So while there was a lot of anti-Shah feeling and a hatred of the Shah of Iran and the United States and the CIA, he and William Rogers investing, the Shah had his money in the foundation, and the head of our CIA controlling matters at home so that the anti-Shah feeling would be suppressed, and there'd be goon squads and the Savak in the United States silencing the people who objected to what was going on in Iran. Over in Iran, the Savak could take care of it themselves. But the CIA and the Savak suppressed the real hatred or feelings for so many years by having goon squads and attacking and killing and controlling the news media. Now I'm going to leave Iran and Afghanistan and the international scenes over there for something important that was in the news this past week that has been pushed off the headlines of most newspapers, and we don't want to lose these articles as they are occurring. One section of articles has to do with the Central Intelligence Agency, assassination teams, terrorism, a cast of characters that will run down the line. It has to do with the arrest of two men in New York City, described as gun runners. But when you read the collection of articles that have come out so far, and there are only three or four, it involves the Central Intelligence Agency, the Green Beret, four Marines, a professional hitman, an assassin, a team of assassination trainers, a man that's training assassins, Scotland Yard, Exxon, Mobil Oil, a New Jersey electronics firm called Amstec Corporation, a Washington, D.C. CIA cover front called Oceanic Corporation. This involves Paris, Panama, London, a cast of characters with CIA safe houses, millions of dollars of weapons for Idi Amin, millions for Libya, millions for the PLO. It's linked, these two men that were arrested in New York are linked to the Munich Olympic Games, the killing of 11 Israeli athletes, the FLAN, the Puerto Rican terrorists, the anti-Castro Cubans. There's a can of worms that has just been barely broken into by the arrest of two people, where this is a large multinational private army, a continuation of that COINTEL program that was going when Richard Nixon was very much entrenched in office in 1971. Two agents from this team, this international team, were arrested at the Hilton Hotel in New York City, and we'll get into the details of what this arrest could mean if it weren't covered up. And again, the Iranian crisis will try to push it out of the news media, and we'll discuss the way the media is handling it. But before I get into that, I want to take two steps. One is the Korean CIA and the assassination teams, international assassination teams. Then there is the Great Britain, London, which is the Permandex, the South American assassination teams with headquarters in Paris, New Jersey, Washington, London. And then combine the agents from both the Korean and the anti-Castro Cuban CIA, and you have a world network of rightist, multi-million-dollar funded terrorism that is causing bombings, airport hijackings, murders. This is not left-wing radical terrorism for more rights. It's not like the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. These are right-wing CIA terrorists who are doing these killings in order to get more police on the streets, to keep people off guard, to kill civil rights leaders, political leaders, to do poison dart deaths that make it look as if the Russians were doing them. We have a network around the world of assassins, assassination weapons, silencers, and so forth. The globe is pretty well covered if you mark it off. But just this week, as I say, there were two articles of these particular things that I'm describing, which are really Nazi terrorisms that were started after World War II, but which are servicing now. Last week, there was an article in the Washington Post, December 22, 1979, another one, the New York Times, December the 20th, 1979, the lead article saying, ex-CIA agent claims the CIA knew of Korean bribery campaign. The other headline article said, ex-CIA officer charges agency withheld data on Korean bribery. The articles involve a gentleman by the name of Philip Leighty, L-I-E-C-H-T-Y. He was the fourth highest-ranking CIA agent in Seoul, Korea, and he claims that the CIA deliberately suppressed information of our U.S. congressmen that they knew as early as 1970 and 71, the height of the Nixon period, just prior to the breaking of Watergate in June 72. They were already providing women and money and jewelry, sexual favors and briberies in order to control a Congress that would go along with Nixon's COINTEL program and his what was the Operation Chaos in the United States and all over the world. This matter of Korean bribery was only investigated after Nixon was out of office and the Watergate stories had been taken off the newspaper headlines for a while. In 1975, they were investigated. But this gentleman claims that the CIA had reports in 1971 and 72 that members of our Congress were being paid off. Now, he claims the Justice Department never investigated that we send our men from, or women, that these were particularly men that were being bribed and kept with prostitutes and money from various sections of 50 states around the United States to represent us in Washington, D.C. And when they get there, they're kept with Korean Asian women and money to run their elections at home, so they don't really need us. And then the CIA knows this and controls them, and the Justice Department refuses to prosecute. And in that way, we're not represented at all, and the whole idea of the constitutional balance, the checks and balances, it goes out the window because the Congress is bribed and paid off, the judicial is strangled and won't prosecute, and the president is put in by these same corrupt forces of the CIA, so that the people, us out there, pay our taxes for the various wars and so forth, or our medical bills if we're poisoned. But this has been going on a long time. The Washington Post article said that the CIA feared that its budget would be curtailed by vindictive congressmen if it ever came out. Well, the truth is that the CIA budget is insured by keeping women for the congressmen. That's the way the budget is raised all the time, and there's no holds on the CIA because the CIA supplies them with their sex and money, and then if they don't give the CIA the money they need, then the CIA can have a scandal and break their reputations. The name of the game, according to Leahy, is sex and booze, all good things Asia had to offer. He was told when he was in the CIA that, and had this high position, that don't ask about Tongson Park, and the agents told him, you know, don't say anything. He's having a conflict. It's a matter of a divorce case in Washington where this came out, and in the course of his personal character, he brought out that he wanted these things open in 70-71 and was told not to do it. And also, the CIA, by keeping this quiet and forcing these situations on the congressmen, assured them of their own funds. The 1978 report of CIA bribery, the one that just came out last year of the Senate Intelligence Committee, was a cover-up, according to Leahy. And of course we know it was. The great Leon Jaworski headed the Korea Gate investigation, and you know how many congressmen, Speaker of the House O'Neill or Carl Albert and so forth, none were prosecuted, even though they kept their little halls, even for bed hopping, right next to the congressional offices. There were places there for them to do their little afternoon matinees or whatever they wanted. Leon Jaworski, who was on the Warren Commission to protect the CIA and the state of Texas for killing President John Kennedy, was brought in as a prosecutor for Nixon's Watergate, then he was brought in for Korea Gate. This gentleman claimed that the report of the Senate Intelligence Committee covered up also the foreign assassinations, that they lied about that, that the CIA concealed for the Senate committee and covered up, and this is the important thing, the assassinations of people overseas. We know they covered up American assassinations. Mr. Blakey, G. Robert Blakey, just finished covering up, again, the murder of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. But Jaworski's committee, again, asked the CIA members if they had any direct knowledge of assassinations. The question should be, did they have indirect knowledge, because the CIA works on a need-to-know basis. But according to Mr. Leahy, by asking if they had any direct knowledge, they could say no, and that the killing of persons, foreign leaders or overseas or even domestically, was covered up by the Central Intelligence Agency on purpose by the witnesses they called and the questions they asked, so that the Washington Post did have an article this week on the continuous cover-up of assassinations, again, headed by Leon Jaworski. He says, Mr. Leahy said they covered up the stories of torture in South Korea and corruption, bribery, and sex. I think Leahy alleged that from 1969 to July 1973, the CIA manipulated all intelligence reports to support any predetermined foreign policy objections objectives, rather, of President Nixon and Henry Kissinger, that the CIA worked with them, lying on the excuse it would hurt national security if the covert operations were really exposed.